Every year, thousands of Americans travel abroad. Students, volunteers, athletes, tourists. Today, we'll talk about the importance of citizen diplomacy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tara Sonenshine is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She'll be speaking in Des Moines this afternoon at Drake University about the impact of international student exchanges. I'll talk with her. Then later in the hour, Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan is an art exhibit that's been traveling the country for the past 2 years. It will be on display in Coralville for the month of September. We'll explore the exhibit. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. And to start off the hour, I'd like to welcome the listeners of FM 90.1, Iowa Public Radio, serving Central Iowa, is now carrying news and Studio One programming throughout the day. If you're a classical music listener, you can still hear classical music on Iowa Public Radio. You can find out all about the flip that has taken place at Iowa Public Radio at the website iprflip.org. But I'm delighted to have you with us today. And every year, tens of thousands of Americans travel abroad, students, volunteers, soldiers, athletes, tourists. Today, we'll look at how the United States is viewed around the world from several different angles. Later this hour, we'll find out about a traveling art exhibit called Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan, now on display at the Coralville Public Library. But first, Tara Sonenshine is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She'll be speaking in Des Moines this afternoon at Drake University about the impact of international student exchanges. Secretary Sonenshine, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's really wonderful to have an opportunity to talk with your listeners.
You took office in May, so you're still relatively new to the job. Can you describe for us what is the focus of your work?
Sure. The Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs really manages and oversees the enormous number of programs that we have that are called people-to-people ties. And as we all know, citizens around the world and citizens here have a lot in common. And often what we think of as diplomacy is thought of in the old-fashioned traditional diplomatic arena, but actually a great deal of diplomacy goes on people to people, citizen to citizen. So I oversee a number of interesting programs, educational, cultural, sports, public affairs, entrepreneurs talking with entrepreneurs, women from different countries speaking with women here. And it really is just a growing and vibrant sector of American foreign diplomacy. So I'm here in Iowa for a conference that is focusing on U.S.-Japan, but looking again at this amazing array of international connections, and your state happens to have quite a number.
Can you give us an idea, when you're talking about public diplomacy, give us an idea of some of the programs that we would have heard of that you feel fall under this umbrella?
Sure. Well, there are many students who participate over years in something called the Fulbright Program, which is really one of the most highly respected exchange programs in the educational area. And just as an example, if you look at Iowa, you could take a woman like Jane Smiley, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction in 1992. Well, Jane Smiley was a Fulbright U.S. student program back in 1976, and many of these folks credit that experience they've had overseas with shaping some of the work they've done. The same would be true of Rita Dove, a Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry. And Rita Dove was one who went on a Fulbright Hayes Fellowship. Chet Colver, known to many of your listeners, I'm sure, as the 41st governor of Iowa, participated not in a Fulbright, but in one of our other programs called the American Council of Young political leaders. So you have all of these interesting people who have gone on these exchange programs and had an opportunity to be somewhere else and then to come back and do interesting work. The same could be said for foreign alumni who come from other countries and then visit an institution in the U.S., and some of those have been in Iowa. So Nobel Prize winners and heads of state would credit some of their early exposure to the United States to these exchange programs. And so monitoring and keeping all of these exchange programs going on the educational side, as well as other sectors, is part of my portfolio.
When you mention these student exchange programs like the Fulbright, when someone is awarded a Fulbright scholarship and they have the opportunity to travel and study abroad, I think a lot of us think of that from the student's perspective of what they will gain and how they will benefit from this experience as their life goes on. But you must also think about what they communicate to people wherever they're going to be staying, living, and studying. Does the program do anything to prepare these students to represent the United States?
Sure. I mean, there are many dimensions of many benefits that you don't quite see. You do think about it as one lucky student who goes to an amazing country, but there is a lot more to it. Firstly, let me address an issue that would probably be surprising to your listeners, and that's the economic dimension of international study abroad. When international students particularly come our way and come to the United States, they contribute, firstly, their ideas and their values and their experiences, but they also contribute to our local economy. So shocking as this may be, if you looked even at, let's say, 2010 to 2011 as the academic year, international students contributed about $280 million to the Iowa economy just in that academic year. So when we go overseas, we contribute to, obviously, local economies. And when students come here, they contribute. In terms of the preparation, what we're really talking about are merit-based students who've begun to excel in whatever area that they're working on, politics or literature, culture. And when they go overseas, they're sharing their talent, but they're also bringing a window onto American life. The other thing that is interesting is that there are families and communities and schools that are also part of this circle, if you will. It's not just the student. So let's imagine for a moment citizen diplomats coming to Iowa. Last year, 755 citizen diplomats in Iowa hosted international students, scholars, and visitors. So in this two-way exchange, you're really participating in a global conversation that is around shared values, ideals. And in the long run, these relationships very much change the way the countries they reflect work with each other.
I guess we're assuming that those interactions are going to be positive. And, mm-hmm. of course, I'm sure they're not always positive. But have we had periods in our past that we've had problems with how people from the United States were interacting with people around the world?
You know, it's interesting. For the most part, particularly when you're talking about young people, they seem to come back, and we have an alumni program that really tracks how folks do overseas and how international students fare in our country. And what's amazing is that many of the experiences that these people have shape the rest of their lives. And when you look at Nobel Prize winners, for example, or presidents of countries, you'll often ask what shaped your experience, your life's work that led to a Nobel Peace Prize or a Pulitzer or just playing a leadership role in your community. And they will say the positive experience they had either in the United States or overseas. So I think the record is pretty good. I'm sure there are examples of when something has gone wrong. With closed societies, it can be particularly difficult if you're talking about North Korea or Iran or Cuba, where it's hard to have robust exchange programs. But even in previously closed societies. Take Burma, for example. We have a Burmese writer coming to Iowa, is in fact here already, participating in the Iowa Writing Program. So even a country that has been closed off and is beginning to open now, we benefit from that Burmese blogger or writer who comes here, and they benefit when you go back, they go back to Burma and talk about the freedom of the press they've seen here or the way Americans live. I mean, we all have misperceptions and stereotypes about other countries, but there's nothing like being at the dinner table or in a classroom or a community to change impressions about one another.
Over the past few years, with our economic problems in the United States and economic problems around the world, have we seen some of these programs fall off in the number of participants, people who just can't afford to travel abroad?
Yes, this is something that we definitely see. And I'm here, as I mentioned, for the U.S.-Japan conference, which is really looking at fostering Japanese culture in the American Midwest. And when we look at the numbers of Japanese students who have been studying in the U.S. for many years, it has fallen down over the past decade almost in half. And that is due to the high costs of making those trips. It's also sometimes an issue of English language capacity for that foreign student coming here and the capacity of language of our students going overseas. And then, of course, it's the question of the knowledge of these programs and what's available. And in reality, what it really is about is getting people to see that we're part of an international community and that it helps a student here economically to know what life and business and work in India is like, for example, or for an Indian student to know the U.S. economy, because ultimately we're in a globally integrated economic world. So there are just so much entrepreneurship and lifelong networks and ties that come from this two-way flow, let alone the art and music and sports that certainly animate many of our relationships, whether it's what you've seen in the Olympics or now the Paralympics, or what we see on art exchanges. There will be artists from Haiti coming to Iowa this fall because of the State Department program. So it's really wonderful to have an opportunity to connect all this for people who probably just are not aware on a daily level of how much interaction goes on.
I'm talking with Tara Sonenshine. She is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She is here in Iowa as part of a conference about the relationship between the United States and Japan, between Iowa and Japan. She'll be speaking at Drake University this afternoon. The topic of her lecture is Changing Minds, Changing Lives, the Impact of International Student Exchanges. She'll be speaking in Meredith Hall on the Drake University campus at 3:30. This afternoon. And we'd like for you to join our conversation. If you've had an international experience that shaped your life, we'd love to hear about it. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Tara Sonenshine. She is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She'll be speaking in Des Moines this afternoon at Drake University about the impact of international student exchanges. And you're welcome to join our conversation this hour as well. If you've had an international experience that has shaped your life, we'd love to hear about it. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And Secretary Sonenshine, you mentioned earlier relationships between journalists around the world. What kind of efforts do you oversee to give journalists from other nations an opportunity to see how the free press in the United States works and vice versa?
So we have a very robust media training program at the State Department, which really helps journalists gather and convene and learn from one another and from us about both professional standards in journalism and about the way to operate in a media environment in which there are changing economics and changing structures to the whole journalism sector. We also work very hard on freedom of the press issues in closed societies. And so, for example, we will, even in the case of Syria right now, try to help Syrian journalists who are outside Syria to get the training they need to be able to operate in a very violent arena. And sometimes that could be even physical safety training about how to deal with situations. And often it's editorial training around how to know exactly what news gathering is really about. And of course, with social media now, you're also training a lot of people in how to utilize the technology of reporting and to be safe online. Often you don't want your identity revealed, for example, if you're in a very hostile situation. So we are doing a lot in this media space and in the social media arena, particularly given how many young people are out there using technology to get their news and information. We now know that approximately 60% of the world's population is under 30. And so access to the internet and access to news and journalism and media content online is a critical part of people-to-people diplomacy.
Things have changed so dramatically in the Arab world in the last year. Have you had increase your efforts to reach out to young people in the Arab world to communicate to them about a free press and about trying to report on what's going on inside some sometimes very volatile places?
Absolutely. And the Arab Spring, I think, for most people now, is a reflection of the power of people-to-people diplomacy. And certainly citizens used social media to connect and convene in terms of being able to find the opportunities to go out and voice their own views as to what they wanted in their lives. But now what happens is after those revolutions or disruptions in the political arena, they have to recreate and construct new societies. And so there are places, for example, Tunisia, where we want to help use the convening power we have to help entrepreneurs reach out to each other and reach out to American entrepreneurs and talk about our lessons learned. Another example with young people from the Arab world is education. So you take a country like Libya, which has emerged from decades of rule under Gaddafi, and suddenly its young people now need whole new forms of scaled-up education. And our country has a lot to offer, both in terms of how we educate students and content as well. And even community colleges in places like Iowa become important models for countries that are trying to figure out how they can create two-year models or vocational training. So all of this people-to-people enables the experience, insights, and wonderful stories and experiences we have to be shared globally.
Have you had a particular emphasis on reaching out to young women in Arab countries?
We have. The women and girls, as we all understand now, all over the world, are really what is known from Nick Kristof, the New York Times writer, as half the sky. And so the State Department spends enormous efforts with the encouragement of Secretary Clinton to reach out to women and girls everywhere and bring them together into entrepreneurial forums with African women, in the Arab Spring case, with all kinds of training programs to unlock this economic potential, to unlock their political power, to unlock their social and cultural traditions, because we know when you unlock potential of people everywhere, you lift all boats, including our own. So the opportunity to really unleash some of the power of women and girls everywhere is a critical part of Secretary Clinton's 21st century statecraft and public diplomacy.
I'm talking with Tara Sonenshine, the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She's in Des Moines today. And we're talking about public diplomacy, citizen diplomacy. And we've asked you to join our conversation. A number of people are on the line ready to share their experiences. And Dennis is on the line from Marion County. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'll try to make it real brief. It's a long story. But my wife's family hosted a foreign exchange student in high school for 1 year from Athens, Greece. Their lives continued on. They've interconnected over all the years, many years. Later, our oldest son was involved in exchange in Asia. Then our youngest son was involved in exchange in France and Germany, where he met a girl that he married, and he lived in Germany for a period of time. And now our oldest son works for a Fortune 500 company and has just been transferred to Brussels, where he represents that company to Europe. And the son of the lady in Athens, Greece, is also assigned to Brussels representing the Greek government. So this whole international life has been started with an exchange program.
So it all reaches back to that one exchange student from Greece.
Right, right.
Well, that's a wonderful and compelling symbol of the powerful friendship and connections that develop between countries, and the ties begin to run deep. And the caller mentioned not only Greece, but Asia. And we are global partners in all of these regions and committed allies and countries that support us and we support. And so this all becomes part of really growing this community. And it's just very exciting to hear from your citizens their interactions with overseas citizens.
Dennis, thank you so much for your call. And Charles is on the line next from Des Moines. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have been part of student exchange programs in Japan and India, and I would like to comment that it's hard to put a quantitative figure on how important it is to understand other cultures. And I think every American deserves the opportunity to experience another culture and come back home and understand what it is that we have here and, you know, the blessings and opportunities that we have in America. I was able to study traditional Indian healthcare as a point. And understanding that and bringing it back home has made me a better doctor, a better person, a better citizen, and a better leader.
That is incredibly exciting for me to hear. The healthcare sector, science, health are two areas where it's pretty easy to make the case that working together, we are more apt to find solutions to disease, to global climate, to scientific discoveries. I don't know if some of your citizens are aware, there was some incredible footage last week of a NASA and a Japanese astronaut, and they were working together to fix a power problem on the International Space Station. And what an image of astronauts together, far away even from this planet, working together. Imagine what we could do on cancer research, on all kinds of health challenges, if we really see this as a community effort.
Charles, thanks a lot for your call. And you talk about collaborations internationally, and we've heard a lot about individuals and what they've gained from these experiences. What do you think it's so hard to quantify something like this. What does it do for the United States to have strong citizen diplomacy?
Well, one thing I would say is when you look at how a society develops and who its leaders become and who are these individuals that are going to shape a country's destiny. And when we discover that leaders of various countries have learned about democracy and governance and leadership and civic engagement from the United States, you begin to see how that working relationship is going to be eased. Two areas that we haven't talked about where public diplomacy matters. One is countering violent extremism. We all know that around the world there are often citizens with very violent ideas or radicalized ideologies and would like to do harm to other citizens. So a new growing area is the use of public diplomacy to really counter that violent extremism. And that means you have to go on the networks and the internet and explain who you are and your narrative and what it is quantitatively and qualitatively that it means to live in a nonviolent society. So that's a burgeoning area of research. The other is around just conflict itself. My work has been in conflict prevention and post-conflict reconstruction. And I can tell you that where citizens are involved, whether it's an earthquake in Haiti or in Japan, or whether it's the outbreak of war or conflict, at the end of the day, these human relationships and ties are going to matter in the crisis moments, and they're going to matter over the long term in terms of building durable, open, tolerant, pluralistic societies, more likely to be open-minded and less likely to be intolerant and conflict-ridden.
You mentioned earlier in the hour the Olympics and the Paralympics, which, of course, is an opportunity for people all around the world to see athletes from all around the world competing with each other. Sometimes when I watch the Olympics, I wonder if the United States represents itself in a positive light with these other countries around the world, because so much of our sport competition seems to bring out the most patriotic feelings of Americans. And, you know, we see Ryan Lochte's grill with the flag on his teeth. And you wonder, does this help our standing in the world, or do we look arrogant?
Well, it's interesting that at the throughout the Olympics, of course, you have this intense competition, and we see that, and it's something obviously people enjoy the game and the winning and losing. It's also interesting that there's a moment at the end of the Olympics now where every nation walks out together. And I do think it's a very powerful symbol at that point that the games are over. There are winners and losers in competitions, but then they come out to honor the sport. And what we're learning about sports diplomacy, and the State Department is doing quite a lot in sending athletes overseas, coaches. We just sent a group to Burma last week, NBA stars and coaches. Is firstly, you can bring sports to underdeveloped and under-resourced parts of the world. There are many countries that don't have the fields and the room and the space that we have, and they don't have the training and the physical education piece. So if we use our sporting talents and dominance in certain sports in a positive way, and if we also bring to the U.S. some of the wonderful athletes from China and ping pong diplomacy, and we could spend an hour just on the athletics of this citizen to citizen, it can be a very powerful tool that creates more of a level playing field, if you will, than a dominance in the sport.
Lee is on the line from Central Iowa. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thank you for your international work, Tara. That's great. I personally was privileged to be a faculty Fulbright a few years ago at Beer Zeit University in Palestine, and it was a great experience. A quick question. Last year during the school year, I worked with some of my students to try to bring a Palestinian youth soccer team over to a youth soccer tournament in Blaine, Minnesota that's held every July. We discovered two big challenges. One was getting permission and the documentation ready to get to the U.S. consul in East Jerusalem, and the second was financing. And I'm wondering if your office would have some assistance in both regards.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me let the listeners know I'm on Twitter, of course, as everybody is, and we can certainly converse. But in terms of behind the scenes, my office would certainly seek to help and find out from our posts in the field whether there is sometimes a block that is in the way. And we'll be glad just to have you call in directly to our office and mention that you'd like some help with that. What I can tell you is that often there are two issues. One is the physical access of visas and paperwork and documentation and sponsors, and those can get very complex, and we try to help sort them out. We have this educational advising function on our websites for each of our embassies. And the second is the monetary issues that you mentioned. And part of what I'm out here doing on the U.S.-Japan front is engaging with corporations and foundations and businesses to make sure that we have many sources, not only the State Department, for underwriting and encouraging all of these programs. I'm delighted that you've been a Fulbright scholar. I'll be meeting three current faculty members at Drake University, all of whom were U.S. Fulbright scholars today. And so this alumni is so rich and robust. But if you leave an email behind with somebody at the radio show or track us down, we'll be glad to see if there's any help we can provide.
Okay, Lee, stay on hold, and we will get your email address in just a moment. What do you see as the greatest challenge for the United States in the next couple of years in citizen diplomacy?
I think that our challenges are threefold. One, we have to build a national constituency for international engagement and citizen diplomacy. We have to go out and talk about what we've been doing in these programs, both here and talk about it overseas. So one challenge is just getting people enthused and excited and sharing their stories. Certainly the economic resources in a constrained economic world put an added onus on those of us who work on these programs to make sure they're well-funded and to make sure people know the economic dividend and benefit that comes from them. And then I think the third is to harness technology and utilize it for virtual exchanges and online training, but also not lose that human touch and that person-to-person, really people-to-people interaction.
Secretary Sonenshein, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tara Sonenshein is the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. She'll be speaking in Des Moines this afternoon on the Drake University campus at 3:30 about the impact of international student exchanges. You can find out more information on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The art exhibit Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan, has been traveling around the country for the last 2 years. It is now at the Public Library in Coralville and will be there for the entire month of September. And with me now is Michael McConnell. He's the regional director of the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Charity. Thanks for having me on.
Can you tell me about the origin of this art exhibit? Where did it come from?
Well, we started it in Chicago. The impetus was that as we looked around and thought about the war in Afghanistan and trying to reflect the human and economic costs of the war, the one voice that was missing was that of Afghan civilians. The debate that goes on about the war doesn't really include the people most affected. And so we felt it was important to bring their voice into the discussion and debate as much as possible. And we did that. We worked with a muralist here in Chicago, fairly famous, John Pittman Weber, and he issued a call to artists all across the country and, in fact, even internationally. And we were asking artists to portray Afghan civilian deaths and casualties through their art on 4 by 6 foot canvases. And we felt it was important to create a large mural, not in a place on a wall in one city, but rather something that could travel around and go to the people rather than the people coming to it.
These are, as you said, large-scale paintings. The exhibit has 45 or more large-scale paintings. Why did you want them to be so large?
Well, we feel that it can easily be forgotten if things are small or hard to see. They're larger than life in a way because war is larger than life. We sent out stories about civilian casualties in Afghanistan and photos to these artists and asked them, give us your rendition, your artistic lens about these. And we got back an incredible amount of creative mural panels that I think portray not so directly through photos, but rather through the artist's rendition and mediation of what this means to the people of Afghanistan.
And you reached out not just to artists, but to students as well.
Yes. We have a couple of murals that were painted by students. One particularly has small self-portraits or portraits of people in children in Kabul, painted by children in Chicago. We also have drawings by children in Afghanistan about how the war has affected them. And these are very powerful drawings as well.
This exhibit has been traveling around the nation for the last 2 years. How do you decide where it's going to go?
Well, there has to be a viable venue. We have three sets. One is the original paintings, and those tend to go to art galleries or spaces that are used traditionally for artwork. And then we have what is in Coralville, our vinyl replications of these, which are a little more portable and a little more flexible in terms of the kinds of spaces that they can be in. We've also had these taken out into public in Albany. A group of women hung these or held these on the steps of the Capitol in Albany, and it was a quite striking visual that talking about the end of the war and right there on the Capitol steps.
When you walk into the exhibit, what does it feel like to be surrounded by these very large paintings?
Well, the first time we exhibited it was at the Quaker Meeting House on 4th and Arch in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it was like being surrounded by all the grief, anger, resilience, and hope of the Afghan people. We have one mural that shows, it's called the Afghan Wedding Party, and it's based on a poster that was first done to condemn the aerial bombardment during the Spanish Civil War. And the picture is of fleeing people in the bottom, and over them is a large dark cloud and rows of drones. And it tries to memorialize the various weddings that have actually been shot upon by U.S. military. So it's sort of a poster that tries to show the human pathos of this event that is supposed to be the peak event of joy in your life, but filled with tragedy. Or there's another mural that is a grieving mother over her son that's actually based on a real photo. And it's an art historian in Chicago who painted this. And she said that it reminded her very much of the Renaissance paintings of Mary over the body of Jesus, grieving. And so she wanted the photo, the painting, to resonate between the reality of Afghanistan and the reality of our faith sometimes.
What message are you trying to communicate with these paintings?
Well, we're trying to say that the people of Afghanistan are very much like the people of the United States. We are all human beings. We share the same emotions of grief and sadness and sorrow at loss. We feel the same anger at those forces that produce those deaths and wounds, and that we have resilience and hope to fight and struggle for a new day where there's no war. And I think we feel overall that if people in the United States knew the human and economic costs of the wars, we wouldn't continue voting for war, and we wouldn't be promoting war, and we would do all that we could to stop wars, because that human emotion of grief is universal.
Clearly, you have a political message in these paintings. What are you trying to say to the government of the United States right now?
Well, the American Friends Service Committee is a pacifist organization, and we feel that if our only tool is a hammer, we tend to see every problem as a nail. And right now, we spend $720 billion a year, which is $2 billion a day just on the military. And if we have that hammer, we're going to be using it, and we're not going to be solving problems through nonviolence, through diplomacy, through other means than the bullet and the bomb. And so I think we're trying to say there has to be another way. We cannot continue in this world as it is to resolve our major conflicts constantly by warfare. And in fact, there's a new study out by Chenoweth that says that war and violence really is only successful in achieving its objectives about 11% of the time, while nonviolence has achieved its objectives almost 40% of the time. So war isn't really that effective. And Stanley McChrystal, the general who was in charge in Afghanistan, even said, for every civilian death that we do in Afghanistan, we create 10 insurgents. And by that calculus, there's been thousands of civilian deaths, unfortunately, many of them at the hand of U.S. drones or U.S. forces, and that we have created more enemies than we've stopped. And so it's impractical as a means of really achieving our ends.
Afghanistan is a country with a long history of war, and it is a damaged country. And, of course, this war has been going on for 11 years. The present administration is withdrawing troops and hoping to have the vast majority of U.S. troops in Afghanistan out by 2014. Do you have an alternative plan that you're trying to promote?
Well, we feel that any resolution to conflicts have to include all the stakeholders, all the people who are involved, and that includes the people of Afghanistan. It also includes other countries in the region. I mean, would the United States stand by if there were forces in Canada, invading forces in Canada? Wouldn't we want to be part of the solution because they're our neighbors? I think if we begin to treat other countries and other people as we ourselves would want to be treated, we'd get a lot farther. It's part of the golden rule, basically. But some kind of negotiations with all the parties involved that is really honest, no preconditions, and trying to get people to talk to each other and resolve the conflict based upon all of their interests as well.
Of course, when this war began, it was started because the Taliban in Afghanistan was in power, and because they were harboring terrorists who were members of Al-Qaeda, which had attacked the United States of America. And in the 11 years that this war has been going on, there has been a great deal of volatility in the government in Afghanistan. If the United States just left and went home, this is not a safe situation within the country. What do you propose?
Well, I think when we've talked to Afghans, they say don't underestimate what we can do on our own if allowed. The Karzai government, by all opinions, is really kind of a puppet of the United States. And while he has been defiant at times, he's in power because the United States decided he was the best person at the time. But I think we have to go back historically to say, why do we keep getting into these situations of war? I mean, if a mass murder in the United States holed up in an apartment building filled with people, would we bomb that building? Would we go to war with that whole building? I don't think so. I think we would try to use all kinds of police maneuvers to try to arrest that mass murderer in the building and hopefully have a trial and due process. The same thing could have happened after 9/11. We could have treated that not as an act of war, but as a crime that it was. And we go after criminals in a much different way than we go after a war situation. So I think, again, it goes back to how we respond to conflict situations. And if we only do it militarily, we end up creating more problems than we actually solve, and harming more people. And that's the point of the exhibit, to show the harm that has been caused to the Afghan people. And we would say needless harm. There could have been another way, even from the beginning.
Of course, that takes us back to a very different political climate in this country. So when you're speaking to the Obama administration about a war that they did not start, that they inherited, what is your message?
Well, they inherited it, but they could have begun to end the Afghan war just as the Iraq war, instead of doing a surge of troops, which resulted in many more U.S. troop deaths and wounds, as well as increased civilian deaths in Afghanistan. There could have been a different way in winding it down. our purpose in going in there was very fuzzy. We think back to 9/11. We had the sympathy of the whole world, including Muslim nations. People were appalled at what happened to us. And yet 10 years later, the animosity around the world toward the United States because of our intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan is at an all-time high. So again, even if we're talking about how people view us in the world, we have lost a lot that we had right after 9/11, just in terms of that sympathy.
When a person walks into this exhibit and looks at these pictures, what do you want us to feel and think as we look at all of these images?
Well, one thing I've discovered is that beauty and meaning is in the eyes of the beholder. And I think everybody has their own sense of what it does to them. But I think there's one mural that is an interesting one in terms of how people could react. There's a young Afghan girl. There's clouds of smoke all around her. She's dressed in blue, and she's caught in white crosshairs. And I think there's two ways of looking at that mural. A person could come in and say, oh, my gosh, she's going to be dead in a few seconds. There's nothing I can do. Or we can look at that and say, the trigger has not yet been pulled. What can I do to stop that trigger from being pulled? And I hope people come in and feel that sense that they can still do something to not only end the war in Afghanistan, but to stop the United States from becoming involved in future wars. Certainly the issue with Iran is on the table. Why can't we resolve that other than through bombardment or warfare? Iranian people are, again, just like us, and they don't want to be killed. They don't want to suffer wounds. They don't want to be part of a legacy of post-traumatic stress disorder. We can do something. We have to vote and contact our legislators and say no to war.
Michael McConnell, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Charity. Really appreciate you having me on.
Michael McConnell is the regional director of the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. They're the organization behind an art exhibition called Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan. It's a traveling mural exhibit made up of more than 45 large-scale paintings by artists from all over Afghanistan. And it actually includes images also created by Afghan high school students as well. That is on display at the Coralville Public Library throughout the month of September. You can find out more about the exhibit online at windowsandmirrors.org. Coming up today on River to River at noon, 35 years after its launch, the spacecraft Voyager 1 is now the most distant man-made object, more than 11 billion miles from the sun. New evidence shows that it's nearing interstellar space. At noon today, Ben Kiefer will talk with Voyager 1 scientist and University of Iowa space physicist Don Gurnett about the next phase of the spacecraft's journey. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Also, Catherine Perkins, our executive producer, is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd like to hear your ideas for things you'd like to hear on the show in the future. We'd like to hear your responses to things you've heard in the past. Coming up tomorrow on the show, our home improvement expert Bill McAnally will be here. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.